let's move on then to the next agenda item, which is rate regulated activities.
I'm Umair Shahid. I will be presenting the session on rate regulated activities today. Between 2018 and 2019, the board has been developing an accounting model that will require rate-regulated companies to account for regulatory assets and regulatory liabilities and provide information about those balances. We last met with you in March 2018 to gather your views on a preliminary set of disclosures we had developed for the model. In September 2019, the board finalized its discussions on the model, tentatively deciding to publish an exposure draft. It is the forthcoming publication of this exposure draft that underpins the objective of today's session on rate-regulated activities. We have split this session into two blocks. First, we will have a presentation in which we will provide you an overview of some of the key features of the model, with a particular focus on the information that the model seeks to provide. Second, we have a few questions for you to help us prepare for the outreach meetings with users during the coming period of the exposure draft. You may have seen that the slide deck includes a comparison of the model with US GAAP in the appendix. We do not aim to go through those slides in this presentation, but we are happy to answer any questions that you may have on those slides. The estimated date of publication of the exposure draft is Q2 2020. The comment period will be 120 days. During that period, we will be reaching out to a wide range of stakeholders, including users. In the following slides, we will present the problem that the model aims to solve, and with the help of a few numerical examples, we will illustrate how the model solves that problem. From there, we will then go into the presentation and disclosure aspects of the model. This slide illustrates the financial reporting problem that the model aims to address. To give a bit of background, in this project, we are aiming to capture a specified set of rights and obligations that arise not from contracts with customers, but rather from the contractual agreement between a regulator and a regulated entity. That agreement establishes the amount that an entity is entitled to charge customers for the supply of goods or services, and when, that is in which period, that amount is included in the rates charged to customers. Typically, the regulator allows the entity to charge customers compensation for goods or services during the same period in which the entity supplies those goods or services. In this case, the revenue amount recognized using IFRS 15 provides useful information to the extent that it tells us what the entity has charged customers from a customer contracts perspective. From that perspective, the information is complete. However, in some other cases, the regulator requires the entity to include in the rate compensation for goods or services in a different period than the period in which the entity supplies those goods or services. This intervention of the regulator causes timing differences that will be trued up in future rates, and as a result, originate rights and obligations for the entity. This economic phenomena is not currently captured by IFRS standards, and from this perspective, the information is incomplete in the statement of financial position, and as a consequence, in the statement of financial performance as well. Just to emphasize what I said earlier, these currently unrecognized rights and obligations arise from the regulatory agreement, rather than from contracts with customers, and so are incremental to those reported using IFRS 15. We move on to the next slide. The purpose of the model is precisely to supplement the information provided by IFRS 15 and other IFRS standards by recognizing the incremental rights and obligations that we identified in the previous slide. We use an example to demonstrate the financial reporting problem and the purpose of the model. This example deals with regulatory assets. The slide represents what happens when the regulator's intervention in the rate causes timing differences between when the goods or services are supplied and when the related compensation is charged to customers. Assume the regulator allows an entity to recover all expenses incurred when supplying goods or services in X naught through the rates charged to customers on a one-to-one basis, that is, without any margins or returns. Therefore, the blue box represents not only the expenses incurred when supplying goods or services, but also the compensation the entity is entitled to for those goods or services. In X0, the entity is only allowed to include in the rates a portion of the compensation that it is entitled to for the goods or services supplied during this period. That period, that is the amount charged to customers, is recognized as revenue in accordance with IFRS 15, as represented by the red revenue box under period X naught. The resulting shortfall in compensation is represented by the pink box under X naught. The regulator allows this shortfall to be included in the rates charged to customers during X1. This means that a portion of the compensation for goods or services supplied in X0 will be recognized in revenue in X1. You can see the revenue box under X1 is much larger than the blue box, which represents the compensation the entity is entitled to for goods or services supplied in X1. The timing difference created by the intervention of the regulator gives entity a present right in X0, because compensation for goods or services it supplied in X0 will be trued up in X1. Without the model, this present right, as represented by the pink box under period X0, is not recognized in the financial statements in X0. Moving on to the next slide, if you focus on this screen, we have a few animations on this slide. The slide illustrates how the model accounts for that present right. The effects of the model are represented by the pink boxes in the second half of the slide. In X0, an entity applying the model would recognize the present right as a regulatory asset, thereby addressing the problem created by the timing difference. The recognition of regulatory asset in X0 results in the recognition of regulatory income in profit or loss. As said, the entity adds the shortfall in compensation for goods or services supplied in X0 to the rates charged to customers in X1. In doing so, the entity recovers the regulatory asset and thus recognizes regulatory expense in profit or loss. Effectively, the application of the model results in reflecting the compensation for goods or services supplied in the period to which it relates, regardless of when the related amounts are charged to customers through the rates. Moving on to the next example, this example deals with regulatory liabilities. Assume that in X0, the regulator allows an entity to include in the rates an amount that prefunds expenses to be incurred when supplying goods or services in X1. The amounts charged to customers in X0 are recognized as revenue in accordance with IFRS 15, represented by the red revenue box under X0. The entity will be supplying the related goods or services in X1, and in doing so, it will incur a higher amount of expense in that period, as shown by the larger blue box under X1. However, in that period, the entity will not be able to include the related compensation in the rates charged to customers. The resulting shortfall is represented by the solid pink box under X1. The timing difference created by the intervention of the regulator creates for the entity a present obligation in X0 to deduct the pre-funded amounts from the rates in X1, because the consideration already charged in X0 will be trued up in X1. Without the model, this present obligation, represented by a pink box under X0, is not recognized in the financial statements in X0. As earlier, the effects of the model are represented by pink boxes in the second half of this slide. In X0, an entity applying the model would recognize that present obligation as a regulatory liability, thereby addressing the effect of the timing difference. The recognition of regulatory liability in X0 causes the recognition of regulatory expense in profit or loss. In X1, when supplying the related goods or services, the entity deducts from the rates the amount it already charged customers in X0. In doing so, the entity fulfills the regulatory liability and thus recognizes regulatory income in profit or loss. Moving on to the next slide, slide 11. In this slide, we discuss the terminology used in the model to explain the origination of regulatory assets and regulatory liabilities. The model uses the term total allowed compensation to refer to the amount an entity is entitled to charge customers for the goods or services supplied. Amounts already charged represent the revenue amounts recognized in accordance with IFRS 15. In the examples that we discussed earlier in slides 6 through 9, the total allowed compensation under period X0 would be represented by the blue boxes, whereas the amounts already charged would be represented by the red revenue boxes. When the total allowed compensation exceeds the amount already charged to customers, as highlighted in the light blue box in the first half of the slide, the model recognizes a regulatory asset. In contrast, when the total allowed compensation is lower than the amounts already charged to customers, as highlighted in the light green box in the second half of the slide, The model recognizes a regulatory liability. Under the model, an entity will recognize the net movement between the opening and closing balances of regulatory assets and regulatory liabilities as regulatory income or regulatory expense in the statement of financial performance. Let's take a look at a numerical example of regulatory assets. This example illustrates a timing difference caused by estimation variances that are at the risk of customers and are therefore captured by the model. Entity A is bound by a regulatory agreement that allows it to include any variances between estimated and actual input costs incurred in the rates charged to customers in the following year. Entity A incurred actual input costs of 1,400 during X1, but was only compensated for estimated input costs of 1,000 through the rates charged to customers in X1. The total allowed compensation of 1,400 for goods or services supplied in X1 exceeds the amount already charged to customers of 1,000. This gives entity A right to add the amount of the variance, that is for 400, to the rates to be charged to customers in X2. The table at the bottom of the slide illustrates application of the model in X1 and X2. The model recognizes the present right as a regulatory asset of 400 in X1, with the consequential recognition of regulatory income in profit or loss. In X2, entity A adds the variance of 400 to the rates charged to customers, and in doing so, recovers the regulatory asset of 400 that results in recognition of regulatory expense in profit or loss. Without the model, the delayed compensation for the related input costs of 400 would have affected profits negatively in X1 and positively in X2, thus causing artificial volatility in the reported financial performance. With the model, the compensation of 400 is recognized in X1 as regulatory income. That is, it is recognized in the period that that compensation actually relates to. Let's take a look at an example for regulatory liabilities. The regulator requires entity A to upgrade a network of water pipelines during X1 that will require an investment of 1,000. The upgraded network will be used for the supply of services from the start of X2 and will have a useful life of 10 years. To support the cash flow requirements for the upgrade, the regulator allows entity A to charge a high rate to customers in X1 that provides incremental cash flows of 500. In X1, no services are supplied to customers using the upgraded network. As a result, the total allowed compensation for X1 is nil and is lower than the amounts already charged to customers of 500. That amount of 500 charged in X1 relates to services to be supplied using the upgraded network during X2 through X11. As a result, entity A has an obligation to deduct 500 from the rates to be charged to customers over the next 10 years. The table at the bottom of the slide illustrates application of the model in X1 and X2. The model recognizes the present obligation as a regulatory liability of 500 in X1, with a consequential recognition of regulatory expense in profit or loss. In each of the years, from X2 through X11, entity A deducts 50 from the rates charged to customers, and in doing so, fulfills the regulatory liability that results in recognition of regulatory income in profit or loss. Without the model, the 500 received in advance would have affected profits positively in X1 by 500 and negatively by 50 each year over the years X2 through X11, thereby causing artificial volatility in the reported financial performance. With the model, the compensation of 500 received in advance in X1 is recognized over the years X2 through X11 as regulatory income, that is, in the periods that compensation actually relates to. Moving on to the next example, next slide. The slide provides examples of other circumstances when timing differences may arise, such as those caused by estimation variances and other timing differences. In example one, we discussed an example of timing difference caused by estimation variances. In example two, we discussed an example of other timing differences when amounts charged to customers pre-fund expenses related to the future supply of goods or services. The other two examples of other timing differences are similar in nature. They arise when the regulator uses different principles or criteria than those used by IFRS standards to establish when expenses are incurred for the supply of goods or services. These arise, for example, when the regulator accelerates or decelerates recovery of the cost of an item of PP&E, or when the regulator provides for compensation on cash basis for expenses that the entity recognizes in its IFRS financial statements on an accruals basis. For example, environmental cleanup provisions.
Andrew, it's just worth just pausing there before we go into presentation disclosures, just to see if there are any questions or everyone's happy with what we've got so far.
In terms of clarifications,
yep.
I think I might have a few just to throw out there, and then we can talk about whether or not they, because you're asking us to give our views on whether this is the right communication. And this one, couple questions I had was that in one situation, it was related to an increase in input costs. Mm-hmm. In another situation, it almost to me was a CapEx item relating to the network. So didn't quite follow how that would flow through necessarily sort of the P&L. Shouldn't that be just a CapEx item, you know, cash coming off the balance sheet? Why is that?
So basically,
and also just related to these increases, these changes in costs to cover the changes in expenses or CapEx, are they considered to be recurring or are they considered to be one-off in nature?
So basically, what we are trying to capture here is the interference of the regulator in the rates that an entity is allowed to charge to customers.
Right.
So in some cases, what happens, that rate which is charged by the entity to the customers is based on estimated amounts. So it basically only gives compensation for input costs on an estimated basis. So when the actual input costs are different than the estimated costs, the regulator allows that difference to be trued up in future rates. So as a result, it will adjust the rate that are charged to customers in a future period. That is what we are trying to capture as a regulatory asset in the time period when that variance actually arises. What happens today is there is artificial volatility created because the regulator has intervened in the rate, and the revenue flows when the regulator allows it to flow in through the rates. So there is a period X1 when the entity actually incurred that variance, but it is not passed through the rates. It is only acknowledged by the regulator to be passed through in the next period. So your revenue recognized by IFRS 15 would be lower in X1, but would be higher in the next period when the regulator allows the rates to increase.
But that one makes more sense to me. It's the one,
yeah.
And the when second, you have a, because I'm trying to think about how this affects the link between the income statement and the cash flow statement, and if it distorts it or makes it,
yes. So basically,
more aligned. So in the second one, there's a big capital outlay.
Yeah.
And so there's maybe a small increase in charges.
Yeah. So what is happening is in the second example where there's a capital expenditure, the entity is funding that capital expenditure through whatever sources it may have, but the regulator is supporting those cash flow requirements partly by giving an uplift to the rates charged in that period. But as a result of that uplift, the entity will not be able to include those amounts in the future periods when an entity is actually using that piece of infrastructure to supply services to customers. So what the regulator has actually done is just front-ended the payments to fund the construction of that piece of equipment. And as a consequence, what would happen is those amounts would be translated into lower revenues in a future period when that entity is actually using that piece of equipment. What essentially happens is that revenue amounts in those future periods will not be reflecting the true compensation which the entity is entitled to because it has already charged those amounts in advance.
So if the regulator would not have approved the pre-funding through the rates charged to customers, and let's say the regulator would have approved the entity to recover the investment through the depreciation of this item, so the depreciation would be the amount that the regulator would have allowed the entity to recover through the rates. But because it received a pre-funding, it means that the portion of this pre-funding that relates to the future depreciation of the piece of PP&E, it's already taking place before the goods and services have been supplied with that piece of PP&E.
Okay.
Do you want to continue?
I just perhaps wanted to come in on, I think, two parts of your question that I thought were quite interesting. I think the first thing is that the accounting right now probably means that the cash flows statement is very closely aligned with the income statement,
yep,
because you're recording cash flows as though they were income. What this will do is it'll actually separate out the two underlying concepts of what the cash flow is about. So in the example of a capitalized asset, you may well have a big cash outflow at the beginning with an expectation of recovery over time. And so you'll now actually record an asset but not a cash flow for that recovery over time. So they will then introduce a difference in the income statement. But I think we think that those two bits of information that are coming.
And I know you're not asking us to comment on the effects, rather how they're being communicated, but I think that's an important to front load, anticipate the questions that come later. That might be really important to highlight.
And then I suspect your other question about the frequency of these types of events happening. I think big capital expenditures is clearly one where this will happen on a very frequent basis. Right. The types of examples we've heard where there might be infrequently occurring circumstances are things like storm damage and the like, where you've been compensated for a specific unexpected event, or where you have been overcompensated for an event that in fact didn't occur. So the storm didn't occur, but you were expecting it. But in the typical run of things, you would expect that the estimates that are being made of what the rate should be are actually sufficient to cover the normal activities of the entity. So it's likely to be the infrequent things that jump out more often than the frequent ones in this. I'm not sure if that helps on that question.
It would be that once the rates are raised, compensate for the capex, do they come back down again? Is that what I was trying to get a sense of?
So
the way,
I suspect what you're probably dealing with is dealing with two types of things. Unusual capex, So a very significant new plant or something that's added, in which case, in theory, the rate will be up for as long as it takes to pay for the plant.
Okay.
But typically what would happen with that is that you would see that the regulator would be trying to help you recover the cost of using the plant. And so by the time you get to the end of this particular life of a plant, you're now thinking about the next plant. And so you've got a bit of a recurring nature from that perspective.
But there's also an important point there as well, which is we're not talking about the right to change the rate going forward forever. It's changing the rate to recover the piece of the compensation for the thing that's already happened.
Okay, so I think, I'm afraid I don't know who was first, but if we start with Deirdre and then Marietta.
I put up my card to give the feedback that I got on these slides. Am I preempting it? Should I actually stall until you get to the end of your presentation?
I would suggest we... Yeah, thank you.
Okay.
Okay, so to be honest, I'm not 100% sure if, like, I'm already starting to provide feedback either, but I do have sort of a number of practical questions on the regulatory assets. I think the model is very clear conceptually, and I also get everything about the liabilities, but, you know, as someone who doesn't normally look at utilities, for me the big question is, I mean, how watertight does that future income have to be in order to trigger recognition, or how much discretion is there actually? So could you actually have a situation where one company just recognizes it and another company in a very similar situation says, I don't trust the government, they might backtrack on promises regarding the rates, or the customer might, you know, go bust or just, you know, move away and use a lot less energy, and I might just not be able to put all of that through. And I don't want the asset to get impaired. And I think that's a related question is, you know, how does an impairment test actually look for those assets? And then the other economic question I have is, if this is, let's assume this is really watertight and the utilities company can absolutely get these monies that are owed in the future in respect of services already provided, then how is that really economically different from invoicing somebody today and just giving super extended payment terms? And I just wanted to give you an example from the pharma world. I think there's some controversy right now in relation to gene therapies where you get like one injection that is supposed to cure you and it costs seven figures. So they know the healthcare system in a lot of cases just can't pay for all of it up front. And they're currently under the impression that they would actually recognize all of the revenue related to that in the P&L straight away, and then just, you know, recognize the cash in the cash flow statement as it comes in. And we're really talking about, you know, extended payment terms over several years. And, I mean, to me, it's really just a technicality whether, you know, you invoice today and say you have 3 years to pay, or whether you say, okay, I only invoice a portion today and another portion next year, another portion the year after.
I think that the first part of your question really ties with one of the key features of the scope of the model. So to be in the scope of the model, we'll need a regulatory agreement, a formal regulatory agreement that is binding on both the regulated entity and the regulator. And binding terms are important so that we can originate assets and liabilities. And The quality of these binding inserts will depend pretty much on jurisdiction by jurisdiction on the specificities and the different features of the regulatory environment. But how sure we would be to recognize an asset, we understand the oversight procedures that regulators perform ensure that all of those timing differences are tracked, are monitored, are audited. And in that sense, when we had to assess existence and certainty, we assess it as being typically low, because most of those timing differences, especially the variance one, are of the type of that they are automatic. So it means that the regulatory agreement contemplates those specific timing differences, identifies them, they are allowed, they have been approved, and the specific term over which those timing differences will be reversed is also identified in the regulatory agreement. So, yes, it might happen that we incurred in a huge repair cost for a storm that it was not envisaged in the regulatory agreement, and therefore then the entity will have to assess whether the regulator will end up approving that, because that piece was not included in the regulatory agreement. But we understand that the regulated entities will have enough experience of instances when this has happened to them before, or instances when this has happened to other entities within the same jurisdiction, regulated by the same regulator. So they will be managed to gather evidence so that the item will to make an assessment of whether the item needs to be recognized or not.
So just to be sure, if I look at your example one on slide 12, this extra 400, so that will basically be invoiced in period X2, even if the customer switches providers or moves away or whatever, so you they would still be able to invoice them for the past service. Okay, all right.
Sorry. Well, let's just be clear about that, though, because what we're talking about here are two different things. So the first is, what are you entitled to charge customers in this period for the things you charge in this period? And that's the people who are the customers in this period. So in this example, we've charged those people 1,000. But the regulatory agreement also gives the entity the right to charge people who are customers in X1 additional 400. Now, that might be the same people, it might be completely different people. In reality, it's probably overlapping. But the people who got their goods and services in X0, that they paid 1,000 for it. That was the price for that. That's the price that's reflected through IFRS 15 and through the revenue line. That right to charge the extra 400 will be revenue next year, and that those will be new transactions with the people who are customers in that period. And we're keeping those two items completely distinct so that the users will be able to see both components of the transaction. Without the model, you'd only see that top piece, the amount you've charged, the 1,000 you've charged customers this year, and the 400 that's going to be in revenue next year.
But that sort of assumes that, you know, sort of you have roughly the same number of customers. I mean, I can see that for the industry as a whole, this works really well. But my concern would be, you know, if, you know, there's suddenly a lot of challenger companies, and, you know, the company that has the regulator asset on its balance sheet finds itself without any customers in X2, then, you know.
So, yes, those balances could be exposed to demand risk, for example. But then when we measure those balances, the requirements would be to update the estimates of future cash flows so that we have the measurement contemplates any changes in the future cash flows arising from those timing differences.
So we don't have a separate impairment test as such. The measurement requires updates of future cash flows to be revised on a periodic basis and to factor in any changes in those cash flows. As well as if there is a time delay, there is no separate impairment test, but the measurement requirements require you to identify whether you are sufficiently compensated in terms of the time value of money and risk inherent in the cash flows. So if for a time delay, the regulator gives a return of 0%, it means that there is some sort of impairment that needs to be taken into account.
Yeah, I think we're also proposing a requirement to disclose any uncertainties about the cash flows that result as well.
Okay.
I think we're kind of, if I jump to slide 21, you know, we're kind of in the realm of question one about questions on the model. And, you know, the subsequent slides that we haven't covered is on presentation disclosure. So If you agree, Omer, what we'll do is we'll take those questions on the model and then we'll come back to the presentation disclosure.
Yeah.
So I saw Jeremy, then Glenn. Deirdre, I guess we have you as well, sorry.
Well, just first about a background question. Has anything changed since IFRS 15, or is this problem independent of IFRS 15?
This problem is independent of IFRS 15.
Okay.
So IFRS 15 basically is capturing only the entity's contracts with customers.
And that was the same.
This is actually the regulatory agreement.
Yes.
It's the
same problem before. Yeah.
Deirdre, should we?
So I asked the users in our team as to what they thought of the standard and the suggested change, and they thought it was a good idea. They said at the moment the experience that they had was that as a user they're using management accounts, which basically makes this adjustment, and they see all of the sensitivities around that, and they obviously make their own assumptions with regards to future customer experience, etc. But the one issue that they were concerned about, and they kind of highlighted it with slide 14, and you have alluded to it, but then I think you backtracked a little bit on the watertightness of it, is how you distinguish between assets and liabilities that are approved by the regulator and then where that negotiation is still ongoing. So initially you said it needs to be binding, which is, you know, what all those examples relate to. That was how we were interpreting those. The problem is, and you then went on to say in the negotiation phase you could use the experience you have with the regulator. It just leaves it open a little bit to company interpretation and that variance side of it suddenly loses the transparency, we'll say, of some of what you're trying to achieve here. So that's just something to put back. How do you distinguish? How do you interpret? Can you put more guidelines around that in negotiation phase? I'm afraid I can't suggest an outright solution to you.
Okay, so right now we have a proposed disclosure requirement that would require entities to disclose the risks and uncertainties that those future cash flows are subject to. Mm-hmm. And regulatory risks, for example, would be one of those risks that we would expect entities to disclose. So in that sense, we hope that this specific disclosure requirement would trigger that entities disclose regulatory assets that are still subject to approval, for example, from the regulator.
Sorry, I think you just need to be very careful on those disclosures.
Yeah.
In terms of, I suppose I'm thinking, my background is actually financials, and we deal with sensitivities the whole time. Can't say I understand them all, but we get them all. And then it's only after the fact that you find out that X's sensitivity, even though the number looked the same, was on a completely different set of variables. And then the transparency that the accounting standard was trying to achieve in the first instance loses its benefit, and the viability of the standard in its first instance.
That's a good point. I wonder whether these assets fall into IFRS 13 fair value disclosures. Or...
No, we won't.
Don't go there.
Sorry, I wasn't.
Glenn.
It seems to me that you've for understandable reasons, you've approached this in terms of modelling the a contractual relationship between two private parties in which you have a right to recover recover revenues and recognise an asset with deferred terms. But the issue here is that you're dealing with effectively a sovereign counterparty who is not necessarily bound, because it's not a contract, it's by law. And the issue that Marietta raised, and I think that Deirdre has raised there, a slightly different one, which is the strength of that contract ultimately comes down to how significant those revenues really are. Because the bigger the revenues, the less likely it is you are going to recover them, because it makes the system unsustainable. So you can think of a situation. I don't think it's quite right that you can walk away from the contractor simply by changing supplier, because very often these underlying networks are monopolies where basically every supplier has to pay them, even if you switch suppliers. But where it could be an issue is, for example, in the issue of the switch from natural gas to electric cars, where suddenly we find that we're burning less power in the power stations because we're, you know, we want to reduce carbon, and we're burning more and we're using more electricity, electric cars, which are using electricity grids much more. So you're getting a switch from a gas grid to an electricity grid, and the volumes flowing, the asset base is still the same, but the volumes flowing on the two different grids are now completely different. And because they're completely different, the amount you can charge one grid system is very different from... And you can imagine a situation where a political regulator might say, and they're all political, we're just going to reduce the rate of return on this one simply because it's going to cost too much to run that system, and we're going to not increase the rate of return on this system because we don't have to, because there's a volume increasing. So net, right? So this is, you know, you can see this might be a problem in Europe, for example, where there's a big carbon debate and a big switch going on from natural gas to electric vehicles, which would be quite a big shift, actually, I think, in terms of this model. So my point is that we have to be careful when describing this as a contract, whereas it is about a relationship between basically an industrial company and the state, and the state is never bound really by anything other than, you know, what it chooses to be bound by in the long term.
Thank you. There are very interesting comments, and especially as you declared, summarized very well, Marietta, so there are some different issues. So we think our model proposed is responding all these concerns. We have tried the best, but still, if you think there's some kind of a shortage of the what you would like to have as some good information, so you know, we need to provide such explanation on the investors' perspective, how our standard is answering those questions, concerns, at least in the basis of conclusion in the coming paper, or if you just provide some kind of exposure draft, that we can put in a basic some explanation how these kind of concerns, quite key concerns, I guess, investors, analysts would like to have some kind of information on this kind of uncertainty and guarantee of the strength of the government guarantee, something like this one, is the very important aspect. So that's why that's very useful feedback to us. Yeah, thank you.
Okay. Time is against us a little bit, so but I think these are useful comments. So we'll go with Peter, Bertrand, Philip, Marietta. Peter.
Thank you. I just had a clarifying question. Where does the demand for this model come from? Is it from the different claimants of capital? Is it from the corporates? Is it from financial analysts? Because it's clear that it's a matching exercise, but it's a special one. It's a non-conservative matching exercise. And so I'm trying to understand where the demand comes from.
When we talked about this a couple of years ago, or at least 2 years ago, Canada was mentioned. Utilities in Canada needed this to...
Daryl, did you want to
answer that? I was just going to say, I think it's probably fair to say that a number of pre-IFRS accounting processes captured these assets, and I think there's a general recognition by both the preparers of these financial statements and those who use these financial statements that there's clearly a asset liability type of thing happening here. So we've seen it in, and Canada's a good example because Canada, in its pre-IFRS world, had this particular type of accounting, and in moving into IFRS has actually allowed an exemption for these entities because they've heard from the industry and from the investors in this industry that this is useful information. So I think the genesis, if you like, of the demand is that people have seen useful information in the past. The board, in fact, had a pre-existing project before this one to look specifically at whether there was a way that assets and liabilities could be recognized because of that demand. And I think it comes from the fact that there's a general consensus that there is some sort of asset-type benefit in the fact that you are going to get these, or that you've, under certain levels of probability, going to get these cash flows. But in the absence of information, people have been using things like management accounts and other sources of information to try and get there, and they want the robustness that IFRS or another framework would bring.
So the way I understand that is that, is there then evidence from the Canadian experience that this type of model does provide better forecasts of future cash flows?
I think that's probably what we've heard from the Canadians that we've talked to over the period, and particularly to the Canadian accounting
body in that we've spoken to. But we've also heard it from other jurisdictions. Brazil is another example that on coming to IFRS abandoned the system, but still believes that there is value in the underlying information that it used to generate.
If I can just answer, I think the other historical is that Canadian GAAP has also followed the U.S., right? And the U.S. had was using this. So in other words, Canadians sort of had that when we went to IFRS, we sort of, you know, didn't lose it, but it made a change. And, of course, we weren't as comparable to the U.S., and there's a lot of Canadian and U.S. Interchange, right? I know I jumped ahead, but I just want to answer that question. But one of the comments I was going to suggest is that perhaps you have to, in your presentation, if you had like a business case or a model, like, because we talk in abstracts in the presentation here, and I think if there's a case, like a business case, where you could actually outline things, I think it just might be easier. I mean, what I ended up doing when I was reviewing this stuff is actually going to some of our Canadian utilities and so on and actually looking at what they do and reading their notes. And that made it clear for me, okay, what is the issue here and what are we trying to really, like, what's the problem we're trying to solve? I think that might address some of the other comments that were made as well.
Thanks. If I could just follow up on your comment, Peter, because you described it as a matching exercise, and I think in a way that's slightly unfair because it's not just about sort of matching for matching's sake and trying to get to smoothness, but there are two types of volatility that could be going on. One is you've got volatility of this kind, like in our timing difference in example one, where something happens but it is going to be compensated in a future period. So there's a direct link between what happened this period and what's going to happen in the future. And then there might be other volatility that you're not allowed to pass on to customers, and that will follow through. If we don't distinguish those things, that the user, I think intuitively it's reasonable the user's going to be in a worse position because they'll get the volatility. They won't know whether it's going to be compensated in the future or not. What this will do is highlight the pieces that are going to be picked up in the future. And so then you'll be able to see the bits of volatility that aren't going to be compensated. They'll be more visible.
That's fair.
So, Bertrand and Philippe?
Yes. I have two questions on the model. The first one relates to the discount rate. What will be the discount rate to measure assets and liability? And how does it affect the revenue and costs? And the second one, again, on regulatory risk. If there is a change in the binding agreements between the company and the regulator, imposed or because there is a change in the agreement, how is it translated within the financial statements?
So the first question you have is on the discount rates or on the measurement of these assets and liabilities?
Yes, and the unwinding of this discount rate.
Yeah, so the board has tentatively decided that the discount rate that we would be using for these regulatory assets and regulatory liabilities would be the regulator's rate that is given on those balances. Yes. So, for example, if the regulator gives the rate of 10%, mm-hmm. that is the rate that we will use to discount those balances. And it is going to keep unchanged over the life of the timing difference unless the regulator changes the rate. But on top of that, the model has an impairment assessment as to whether the rate that is offered sufficiently compensates the entity for the time value of money and risk inherent. If, for example, the discount rate is 0% for an asset which remains outstanding for 2 or 3 years and the effect is material, then as a result, the model recognizes an immediate impairment loss on the asset side. Your second question was on?
A change in the agreement.
Okay, so normally what we expect, like these agreements, it could be a separate regulatory agreement or it could be laid down in a statute, it could be legislation. For these cases, we don't expect that there will be significant changes in the regulations from time to time. But even if there is a change, and as a result, there is a direct consequence on the estimates of future cash flows, the measurement of regulatory assets and liabilities would be updated to reflect any changes in estimates.
Great. Philip?
Thanks. Sorry, just stepping back from the model for a minute. You know, I'm assuming these balances aren't recognized at the minute because they don't meet the definition of an asset and a liability.
As of now, we have like IFRS 14. That is a temporary standard that was issued back then to allow companies, because these assets did not meet the definition of assets and liabilities under IFRS standards. So there is a temporary IFRS 14 standard which allows type of these assets to be recognized because of first-time adopters that have previously recognized these balances. They are continuing to recognize these balances at the moment.
for the plans to carry on that sort of special exemption?
No, because the new conceptual revision to the conceptual framework would allow these to be recognised as assets and liabilities.
As a result, that temporary standard would be withdrawn?
Well, just to be clear, there are different views about whether they met the definition of assets or liabilities under the old framework, and the board hasn't had to answer that question and doesn't think it's useful now to answer that question with hindsight. The board is clear that they do meet the definitions of assets and liabilities under the new framework.
Great. So we've got Marietta, then Jeremy.
Just a very brief, very general comment. Whenever the accrual and the cash accounting diverge, it makes analysts work very hard. That doesn't need to put you off doing it whenever it's the right thing to do, but I just wanted to flag that it does increase an extra level of complexity, and maybe here for the rate-regulated stuff, it might not be as complex as for pharma, but it's just something you should always keep in the back of your mind as well, because I think pharma analysts nowadays are really struggling with the massive difference between the timing of the cash flows and what's flowing through the P&L.
It was just really feedback from, I talked to our utility analyst, and his main point, I suppose, was that the regulated asset base and the regulatory accounts are the main source of information, so this would be more marginal from his perspective, from a specialist perspective. In terms of the slides, I know you mentioned maybe indirectly, but the depreciation rate you thought was a big point, the difference between the regulated life cost-base method, and in terms of interpretation of the asset and liability, I think some are cash and some are non-cash, and maybe it's hard to distinguish those two parts. And also some of them form part of the regulated asset base and some may not. So again, that separation is useful to flag. And then the comment on the discount rate, that introducing variability as well into this. So altogether, I think the feedback was that in this make it more difficult to reconcile these new model accounts back to the regulated asset base, so that was seen as a disadvantage. So to make it as easy as possible to go back to the regulator's worldview would be helpful.
We understand that right now some entities find it difficult to provide meaningful reconciliations between the regulatory balances and the IFRS balances, because the regulatory capital base, it's a pool of items that might not necessarily be linking directly with the intangibles or tangibles registers. In addition to that, they might also include operating expenses. We have heard the case of including even a bonus that the regulator considers in the regulatory capital base and will allow their entity to recover in the future. So we have had some feedback stating that reconciliation would not be necessarily meaningful. We have the case of a utility company in Europe, and if you take a look to the financials, they said that they had been privatized 30 years ago, and therefore they still have significant differences coming from the regulatory capital balances and the local GAAP at that time. So they said, well, it is impossible that we provide something that is meaningful to users. But having said that, so we always wondered, why is this reconciliation useful to you? What do you do with this reconciliation? What do you use it for? So this is a piece of information that we haven't gotten in detail. So I don't know whether this is the appropriate moment, but this is something that we will also like to understand.
Maybe your team analyst needs to speak to these.
It may just be the difference between a specialist and a generalist. I suppose the specialist doesn't need to reconcile. He's happy with the regulatory world view, whereas the generalist looks on the Bloomberg screen and sees a certain number and wants somehow that to link back ultimately to the cash flows, how it works.
The answer to that question is very simple, which is that the regulatory asset, you're right, the capitalization policy of the regulator is not necessarily the capitalization policy in the accounting standards, or for that matter, in the tax accounts. So you need to think about these things as three different books reflecting the same underlying reality with different capitalization policies, different expensing policies. Tax accounts, regulatory accounts, financial accounts. They're all performing different functions. But the reason the regulatory accounts might be important is because the regulatory accounts are normally indexed to inflation and what model equivalent assets, the capacity, so the old current cost accounting view of the world where you're maintaining a certain capacity on the network, and that that capacity is being managed in real time and in real money. And because you know that that is rising in value, then you know that the difference between the regulatory assets and the financial assets, the bigger the gap, the more likely it is that your revenue line or your EBITDA line is going to be rising in future, because the financial accounts are going to converge to the regulatory accounts. So the bigger the difference between RAB and financial assets, the discount to RAB, the more likely it is that your revenues are going to be rising, which is unusual for a utility, because we tend to think of utilities as not having growing revenues. But if you can spot that your regulatory asset base is higher than your financial assets and is growing faster than your financial assets, you could pretty well predict that dividends are going to be rising faster than inflation. That's a hell of a thing to say for a utility. That's why people are interested in it.
And I think maybe we want to move on to the...
Maybe we should go into the questions, given the feedback. And where we're going to run out of time, and you won't get what you're looking for. Is like, is this? The questions are: is this clear? Is there a better way to communicate this? Probably one would guess that from all the questions around the table, there might be some way to simplify things or clarify things. But
sorry, just to understand. So we're now kind of thinking about the question two on slide 21. We're looking for, so. I don't know if people have any additional comments with regard to that question too. Maybe while you're thinking, I'll just give my feedback in terms of, I found it very helpful that, first of all, the slides themselves are pretty clear, but the text that accompanies the slides is very helpful as well. So I'm no means a specialist in this at all, so my specialism is more in the bank space, but it did help, and it's probably the first time I fully understood kind of some of the underlying issues. I think somebody commented that maybe kind of a real-life example, real extracts of, I don't know, some of those guys that are using IFRS 14 could be a helpful thing to bring it to life. Any other comments on actually the deck itself? Peter, please.
Some numbers in the beginning of the slide deck, when you do the introductory examples, there are boxes only. And it would be helpful if you could put some numbers in, simple numbers. Okay. And if you look at the deck, you have on the left side or the debit side, I'm not really sure whether this is debit or just an explanation to what you can charge the customer in total. But to me, it looks like an income statement, but probably it's not. Because the blue box is bigger in the beginning on the first slide than the blue box on the right-hand side. So obviously you want to give us some kind of information that the blue box is the basis for the calculation, right? Mm-hmm. So that must be made clearer. So you, because I started to look upon this as income statements, and I couldn't really understand why the cost the second year, the X1 year, was so much smaller. Normally they are rather constant over time. So you need to explain that better. And I would have preferred to have some numbers into the boxes.
Okay, Bertrand?
Yes, one suggestion. It would be nice to have a presentation where you show how does it affect or doesn't affect the cash flow statement, because we are used to use it.
That's a good point. Sorry.
Let me just second that notion. Promotion, but second that thought. As you can see from my question, I think others have expressed that as well, and make it very clear in the beginning that what kind of divergence it creates in terms of cash flow and income statement. Yeah. Because Mayor's comment, I think, is good. Is like, you know, it's fine if it serves an important economic purpose, but the effects need to be better understood.
Yeah. Rosemary?
I was just going to comment on Peter's, because I had the same question you had, and I was going to suggest maybe why they've done it, but then it's inconsistent in other slides, so maybe I'm incorrect. But anyway, I was just going to say, are the boxes smaller in period X1 for expenses just because of the way the diagram's done, because you got arrows, or are you intentionally want it to be smaller?
It was supposed to be intentional to just depict this, the amount of the compensation to which the entity is entitled to.
Okay, thanks.
This team clearly likes numbers, so I think that's one
I quite like the boxes personally.
Sorry, but
yes, still one very small suggestion. In the presentation material, you use 1,000 capex and 500 pre-funding. Would it be better to have 6 to 400? Because we would be more useful, more
good.
Yeah. Numbers that need to be accurate. Any other comments? I mean, I did want to allow some time for this presentation disclosure. I don't know if it's possible to give us a even more succinct overview of this. Oh, sorry, Mitch, did you?
No.
Yeah, if that's possible, maybe we can cover it in a few minutes and then pick up any final questions. So, moving to the presentation and disclosure requirements quickly. In the statement of financial position, the model requires presentation of regulatory assets and regulatory liabilities in separate line items. In the statement of financial performance, the net movement between the opening and closing balances of regulatory assets and regulatory liabilities is required to be presented as regulatory income or regulatory expense line immediately below the revenue line item. It is immediately below the line item because it supplements information provided by IFRS 15 in the revenue line. The presentation requirements of the model do not override the presentation requirements of other IFRS standards. So we can see this in the next slide. In this slide, we are trying to illustrate the information that the model seeks to provide. We have illustrated the presentation requirements of the model for periods X1 and X2 using examples 1 and 2. We have also provided information about the breakdown of figures for revenue and regulatory income or expense line items. The red lines represent accounting and presentation under existing IFRS standards. For example, revenue represents amounts recognized using IFRS 15. The green lines represent the accounting or the effects of the model. In X1, there is an origination of regulatory asset and regulatory liability of 400 and 500, respectively. At the end of X2, the full recovery of regulatory asset reduces its carrying amount to nil, and the part fulfillment of regulatory liability reduces its carrying amount to 450. Without the model, a profit in X1 would be 600, that is by ignoring the regulatory expense of 100. And in X2, the profit would be 850, that is by ignoring the regulatory expense of 350 in X2. With the model, the compensation is recognized in the period that it actually belongs, regardless of when the related amounts are charged to customers through the rates.
Could I maybe just sort of add to that one? So looking at slide 17, just sort of trying to explain what you're seeing on the front page there. So if we take X1 as an example, so applying the existing standards, we're showing revenue of 7,500 in accordance with IFRS 15, and we've got expenses of 6,900. So those are all things that relate to goods and services supplied this year. The regulatory income line, which is a net of 100 in this example, is things that relate in some way to goods or services that would charge to customers in a different period. We've struck a subtotal there of 7,400. The ED isn't going to propose requiring a subtotal, but it's also not going to prohibit it. But that subtotal's actually got a meaning. That total of 7,400 is the total amount that you're going to be allowed to charge in some period for the goods or services delivered in this period. So what you'll see is, you, looking at this overall picture, you've got the 7,500 you were able to charge customers this period. Overall, you know you're going to be able to charge 7,400 in total for the goods and services supplied this period, and your expenses for supplying those goods and services this period were 6,900. Now, that net 100 is made up of various different cases which are broken down in the notes, and we've tried to give relatively plain language descriptions of them on page 19. We probably still need to work a bit hard in trying to make the descriptions more plain language, which I think will be important for communicating with the users, both the specialists and probably even more importantly the generalists. But that's really the heart of what the model's trying to tell you is how much are you going to be able to charge customers in some period for the things that were supplied in this period.
Okay. So we can now move on to slide 18. This summarizes the disclosure requirements of the model. The specific disclosure requirements of the model, in summary, require a breakdown of regulatory income or regulatory expense line, a maturity analysis, discount rates used for measuring regulatory assets and regulatory liabilities, and a reconciliation of the changes in the carrying amounts of regulatory assets and regulatory liabilities. This slide illustrates, using examples 1 and 2, the disclosure required for the breakdown of regulatory income or regulatory expense.
Amounts in X1 represent origination of regulatory assets and regulatory liabilities, and amounts in X2 represent recovery of regulatory asset and part fulfillment of regulatory liability. The net result, which in this case is regulatory expense for both X1 and X2, plus the revenue line item of IFRS 15, represents the compensation the entity is entitled to for goods or services supplied in the relevant period, regardless of when the related amounts are charged to customers. Moving on to the final slide, which is on maturity analysis. The numbers in this slide are not related to examples 1 and 2. As shown by the slide, regulatory assets represent amount that will be added to the rates, and regulatory liabilities represent amount that will be deducted from the rates in future periods. The model also requires disclosure of information about how the future reversals of regulatory assets and regulatory liabilities are affected by risks and uncertainty, such as regulatory risk or demand risk. This information has been requested by users for a long time, and the model will now provide it. So this brings us to the end of our presentation. I think we have already spoken about questions 1 and 2 earlier, so we will move on to slide 22. The model will affect entities that are subject to a specific type of rate regulation that creates regulatory assets and regulatory liabilities, and that is found in some industries. But it will not be a standard that will affect all preparers across all industries. The input of specialist users will be key. However, during the comment period, we also want to gather feedback from the users community as a whole, and that may be a challenge. So our question for you is, what advice can you give us on how best to reach out to generalist users on a topic that is highly specific?
When we had this discussion a couple of years ago, it helped me to look upon the key issues in the same way as I look upon percentage of completion method instead of completed contract. Normally, I can see from the footnotes that this obviously is a liability and an asset that stretches over 10 years or something, given the footnote. But in my view, if I try to take this into a Swedish context, it is about 1 or 2 years normally. And then it fitted my mind to look upon it as the same kind of problems as we try to solve with percentage of completion.
Thanks, Peter. Jeremy.
Just one point. I mean, maybe there's some, in my mind, is parallel to the deferred tax. So the question from a generalist and evaluation perspective, are these assets and liabilities operational financing? And if they're financing, if we treat them as kind of quasi-debt, firstly, can we see which of the liabilities will result in cash outflows? And can we tweak it to get to an equivalent debt number? So those would be the questions I'd have in my mind.
So basically, these are, how we see them, they are basically more operational because they are essentially pre-receivables because they will be converted into revenue at some point in time, or they are already part of revenue at some point in time. So we don't see them as financing as such.
If it would be a big one-off number, maybe you would treat it as a an offset or addition to cash. I'm just, in terms of the asset base, is this really an asset that is needed perpetually in the business or liability, or is it something that just diffuses over time?
It diffuses over time because all it does is trying to capture the timing difference between the amounts that are charged now and that will be charged in the future. So it is just trying to correct reflect the timing of when that amount should have gone through the P&L. So it will, when the rates are adjusted, that balance will disappear.
Mm-hmm. So in the second example, the regulatory liability started in X1, but then we account for a regulatory liability of 500, and this liability will be reversing over X2 until X12
or X11. Over 10 years.
Okay.
Sorry. So most of it was clear, but on slide 19... So the first part is you've got the asset that you're setting up, and you're going to receive that in income over time. And then the second part, the 500, is the liability. Why do we have to take anything into income? Like, why do you have to take that 100 into income in year one, in that year? Because both the asset and liability are in future periods.
because the 400 is consideration that we have not been charging in X1, but we should have because we delivered those goods and services, and by doing so, we incurred in higher input costs of 400. So it is income that we have the right to charge in X2, but we should have charged it because we have incurred in those expenses when delivering those goods and services in that period. And for the case of the liability, we have received this 500 in advance of having supplied the related goods and services. So we have in revenue 500 that it is should not be compensation for the goods and services supply because we haven't supplied anything.
Okay, so in this example, you've already reflected those in the P&L, and now you're making that adjustment. But if today was the first day, like if starting today, you had nothing in your P&L, right? So you have this asset, you have this liability. You wouldn't put that 100. Let's just say, I mean, I can't think of an example, but I don't know. The company is awarded something through some, you know, through the government to charge a higher rate, right? So you're going to have a future, there's an asset, and you're going to take that into income in the future. In that example, like if you start sort of almost like a greenfield example, then that 100 wouldn't go through P&L. Am I thinking of it correctly?
Okay, so you mean like you haven't charged anything to customers yet, so your revenue amount would be zero because you haven't been able to charge anything yet. But you do have
assets.
The right to,
right.
That would be still a regulatory income in the P&L, even though you might not have to charge anything through IFRS 15, let's say, in that period.
It would still go through P&L?
Yeah.
You kind of said it's greenfield, so there's nothing provided to customers yet. Is that your point?
Yeah, I'm just...
Then I think it would be nothing on the... That's right. I'm saying potentially...
Yeah, you'd have no revenue in that case because you wouldn't have charged customers anything, and therefore you also wouldn't have a regulatory liability because you haven't charged customers anything, so...
Right. Yeah, I guess what I'm trying to say is that the asset that arises and the liability is conditioned on something else that happened in the past.
Yeah, that's right.
Yes.
So you have a P&L...
That's
but
right.
You could have a situation where if something, and I can't think of one, but you know, where it's a brand new, I don't know, it's a new asset for some reason, right?
I mean, there are two triggers. So for a regulatory asset, the trigger is that you've supplied goods or services, but you haven't yet been able to charge the customers, or at least not the full amount. And the flip side, the regulatory liability, is that you've charged customers for something, but you haven't yet delivered everything you need to. From the perspective of the contract with the customer, you have delivered everything you need to deliver, but when you look at it with the slightly broader perspective of the regulatory agreement as a whole, you haven't yet delivered everything you need to.
Okay, well, so let's say you've delivered, you know, the services. Mm-hmm. The regulators change the rates used on something. In that example, would something go through P&L? Because it's a change in the rate that's going to be in future periods.
If it relates in some way to what you've already done this period, so we're not talking about the regulator decides that next year you're going to be able to double your rate or increase your rate by 10% because the regulator thinks that's a better rate for the future. What we're talking about is cases where the regulatory agreement is going to adjust the rate for the future because of something that's already happened and to recover some effect that's already happened.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Okay, so between me and Coffee is Marietta and Terence, and I think we will close at that point. Marietta?
Thank you, first.
Sorry.
Okay, well, I only have a very short comment anyway. I mean, coming back to what Rosemary said, I think it's very important for, you know, generalist users to actually just separate very clearly in the P&L what is actually revenue related to stuff that you've charged in that period. It wasn't 100% clear to me whether they're always required to separate that, but I think, you know, once you start mixing the two, it becomes very transparent.
These are quick. On the proposed disclosure requirements, it doesn't specifically say, but are you proposing to include sensitivity analysis around the discount rates?
There is a small requirement which says if we are using the discount rate, which is not given by the regulator, so if the regulator gives 10%, but we are using a different discount rate, let's say 8%, then we need to explain that and why.
And in practice, does that have a material impact on the asset or in the income or the discounting of it?
It will depend on the quantum of the outstanding regulatory asset or regulatory liability.
Because I guess I'm a generalist, but I would be interested to know if that was material. I'd want to have that sensitivity explained. And then one other thing was, if back to Marietta's point from earlier, if there was an impairment in any of the assets, would that be proposed to be put into the regulatory income expense line, or is that going to be separate?
No, it will be within the regulatory income or expense line.
So it might be helpful then, just as the practical example, to maybe put that line in so people understand that it would go through there as well.
Great, thank you. I hope that was helpful to you guys and certainly helpful to me. So it's very interesting, conceptually beautiful model, but clearly listening to some of the questions, there's some real-life concerns about abuse, I think, perhaps. So we're slightly behind schedule, but that's fine, because we can just eat into the more than 1 hour that we have for lunch. So when should we...
A 10-minute coffee break, start at 5 past 11. So
5 past 11 then. 5 past 11.